It is my pleasure to introduce our speaker from the American Ethical Union, Martha Gallihue. Martha's spiritual activism began with her mother's engagement in human rights in the 40s in Zanesville, Ohio. It was nurtured for 11 years in a Roman Catholic convent where she taught religion, literature, creative writing, Latin, and journalism. She completed her theological studies at Union Theological Seminary, Columbia University with special focus upon Alfred North Whitehead and Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. She became an ethical culturalist in 1997, which is also when she began her first service in the Maine as the Maine representative at the United Nations for National Service Conference, now known as the National Ethical Service. In 2007, after 4 years of training, she was certified as an ethical culture leader and worked at the Essex Society in Maplewood, New Jersey from 2011 to 2016 while continuing at the UN. She now represents the United Religions Initiative at the United Nations, a group of over 1 million activists in over 100 countries. Please join me as we welcome Martha Gallihue and her talk, Spiritual Activism, A Humanist Perspective.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for having me, and I wish you all the best in this sleety weather. I know that it always brings up changes, and so the song was relevant and moving, deeply moving, for many reasons. I love the last verse. I don't know what Bob Dylan would think, but it certainly fit today. So there's a Japanese proverb that says, vision without action is a daydream, and action without vision is a nightmare. And I was telling the youngsters during the children's part of the program about some of the mistakes that I made when I was young and was trying to work all this out. This morning I was telling Jill and Bill that if I were to change the title, and I keep working on it and keep changing this, I think the next time around it's going to be called Active Spirituality. Because for me, the term spirituality is really a term that's not, I don't know if Bono's going to be even using that word as he grows up and moves on, because it's not a separate thing from who we are as human beings. And for some of us who have been focused on spirituality from a lot of different perspectives, including the scientific one, it all gets down to the notion of what we think of as love and what it is to be one humanity and where we find ourselves in it. So that could be the end of my talk, but I thought what I would try to do is to start with a personal description of what I mean in terms of our personal practice, because it has to do with our sense of who we are. So let me start with the notion that imagine if we began life and went through life knowing how good we are, that we started from the premise, yes, we're flawed, and yes, we're limited, and yes, we make a lot of mistakes. That's what it is to be human. But the fundamental premise of who we are is that we trend toward goodness, we trend toward altruism. And that's in our being. And that if we were to grow up in the kind of world that we want someday, and our children hopefully will continue to have, it would be based on this goodness, a fundamental trust in the very fiber of our being, that however small we are, we actually have the power to make a difference. And the difference is not so much in fixing things. It's not so much about the outcome. I was telling Bono and Luke that when we come up with questions, it's not that we get the answers, it's that we come up with better questions. And that in a lot of ways, life is so much about how we are shaped, so much about how what kinds of questions we're asking ourselves. So the first thought about spirituality is the experience of being in the being that we are. So I think when I look back, one of my questions was, what is possible? And that out of that came a kind of activism. I don't think essentially I was an activist. I think what happened is the sense of energy and passion that grew up in me in terms of seeing how much alike we are in so many different pathways, that I realized that all along, all my life, I was asking what is possible. And it took me to the next place, which is my own being. So I was going to suggest, if you like, that I was originally going to ask you what your own notion of spirituality was, but then I thought, what if we just did a reflection? What if we just did a relaxation? And we took a minute or two, took 4 or 5 minutes, to just close our eyes, be in the space of ourselves, and thought about us as microbes on the planet that happen to be organized around what we call human. And that we got in touch with a kind of gratitude that we're alive, that we're special because we're alive, not for any other reason. Some of us may be brilliant. Some of us may have marvelous talents. Some of us may be disabled. Some of us may be disgruntled. None of it is really very important. But we are alive. And that in our livingness, we breathe the same air, we drink the same water, we eat the same food. And we speak the same language of the heart, if not words. And that language of the heart is gives us a quality of empowerment. The empowerment to be alive, to succeed and to fail, to move toward, to move away, to choose who it is that helps us and who it is that holds us back. And to understand that if we're here, some part of us knows, because we have agreed that what brings us together is this sense of infinite worth, not in terms of quantity, but we attribute infinite worth because we, out of all the possibilities, were given the opportunity to be alive. And that a lot militates against us staying connected to our livingness. And that if we understood that really what the challenge is to be in complete freedom. We know about the freedom from want and hunger and the right to speak and those. But do we think about the freedom toward? The freedom toward making the world better. And today, we automatically are making the world better when we tell the truth. To recognize that when we speak truth, we don't know all of truth. But when we speak truth, we trend toward truth. And in that way, we are contributing to the world that we want to be. So part of our spiritual practice is to do a kind of assessment that is very affirming. Not in terms of what is wrong with others, but how well and how open are we in speaking the truth that we understand, and bring to that a willingness to listen to the truth that someone else may understand. And that we give ourselves the right not to speak when we know that we're speaking to a closed door. We don't have to pursue dialogue that takes us into debate. We don't have to go there. Rather, we're helping more when through art and music, we speak truth that throws out into the atmosphere the energy of truth. So that when we come together in ethical culture, we also say that we aren't needing to be in agreement about every point. That doesn't matter to us. But what does matter on the personal level is that we learn to let go of judgment. That's not the same as letting go of assessment. It's not the same thing as letting go of critical thinking. It's more that we let go of needing to react against someone who speaks words we do not agree with. It means that we will be brave and try to find the language that others might understand and adhere to. So we might spend our time, instead of thinking about what we want to put down, we'll think about, well, what might be the thing that we would have in common? So we can say, well, even as bad as we find a divisiveness in the country, for example, we are starting to find agreement when it comes to our process with criminal justice. And so that's something. So what we would say as a spiritual practice in being human is to find the points of agreement that also allow us to be refined in our thinking with regard to critical discourse. And so we would allow ourselves to be able to recognize facts as we know them are always unfolding. So the facts are our beginning point of speaking toward truth. So spirituality, for me, though it did involve the practice of certain disciplines and certain asceticism, fundamentally I learned that ascetic practice is something where we actually make an adjustment to set the part of ourselves aside that is opinionated, that has been schooled in a certain way of thinking about something. And those of you who are parents can know how much the influence of your children has changed your thinking or some of your assumptions. And that's what we mean when the times are changing today. They're radical, radical changes. And as things are and will get worse because of climate change, at the same time the scientific breakthroughs are so astonishing that it is a matter of science to see beauty and coherence in the universe. And that the fact is we are made up of the stars. We are the same stuff. So that we have the freedom to think as big as we need to. And that what sometimes is tough for us is that when we've been hurt, or when we have been truly even assaulted, it's hard to let go of the experience in a way that we do not forget it. But we understand that is not who we are. And therefore we do not have to hold on to it. as something to somehow be a part of us. We are not a part of that which is evil when we choose to do the best that we can. And when we come from that place, we become very courageous. We realize, you know, when we have a profound sense of this human goodness that is the forward trending of humanity, and I can say that, I think the obvious thing, the reason I appreciate your mentioning Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, was he was silenced within the Catholic Church, because he began to see and to say through paleontology that stones are alive, that there's an energetic reality to everything that has form, and that it is alive, and that the ultimate authority for humans is the connection to nature, which is the second major point of ethical culture, that we don't make a distinction between supernatural and natural. So when I talk about spiritual activism, I am saying that as much as I studied about God, and I continue to hold on to that as an unfolding concept consistent with what we know in science, because I believe that humans actually have the imagination to be cosmic in their thinking. And that it makes me, my adherence to that term is not the adherence that it was when I was a child. It's more a matter of my own personal need to see that there is a oneness in everything that does not eliminate or preclude or in any way contend with diversity. The greater the diversity, the greater the unity that we can find. And that was Felix Adler's primary, most profound focus, which he understood that if he was a progressive Jew when he was brought up, if we allowed for revelation only through the prophets, what about Asian culture? What about African culture? There couldn't be that possibility. So he shifted the way of thinking to say, yes, let's go to the sense of oneness and let's not give it a name. And that's the essential position of the humanist. Let's not call it anything. Let's not say God. Let's say that humanity is the one species that has the level of consciousness that can grasp a holistic understanding that would allow us to see the livingness in a stone, as well as the notion that we've always known that planets and hang together in a solar system, and we've known that the sun is just one of many, many solar systems, and now we know there are many, many galaxies and all of that, and that it seems to be continue to be unfolding. We can, if we choose to, become cosmologists of an entirely different nature. I won't go down that route because I'm not a cosmologist, but I would simply say that sometimes we come from traditions that had just a piece of something that was wildly important, and then it got subverted in sort of institutional frameworks. So beginning with personal spirituality, and again, I honor the fact for Bono and Luke, you don't have to call it that at all. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to me if we hold to God or not God, because a lot of times when we're older, we grew up with certain concepts that we just use for shorthand. But as we say, things are changing and the times are changing, the language is changing too. And that humanists don't need any ideology in order to open up this quality of unfolding. So my second point, and I wanted to make this the topic somewhat short, if that's okay. I was hoping for another 5 or 10 minutes on group and another 5 or 10 minutes on the UN, and then you can ask me anything you want to ask me. But it is this notion of embracing. We've come together because there is something in us that chooses to love ourselves, first of all. So when we do assessments, it's not critical assessment. And that we, in fact, recognize that the better we know ourselves, the more a mystery other people are. So we need them to tell us what it is they're holding on to. And we need not we can't help but feel fear and anger and to feel paralyzed sometimes when we hear some of the things that are going on. And I know that you've been told this before, but that what we want to do is to recognize spiritual practice, first of all, has a lot to do with focus. It has a lot to do with a quality of reflection that includes focus. So there's not a well-known monograph, but I found it somewhere, and I keep losing it. But Felix Adler wrote a monograph on spirituality, and he held to 3 points. He held that the basis of a profound humanist spirituality was reflection. So you and I just went through an example of the kind of reflection that I'm talking about. And that demands a certain amount of solitude. So not to be afraid to be alone is a very important first principle. His second point, which ironically for me has to deal with groups, is called detachment. And that he said a lot of things that we're kind of wedded to. And that's why I appreciate the ethical education that is focusing on world culture through food is opening up a kind of cultural diversity that goes right down into the body and can open up into all sorts of common understandings and questions and people. So with detachment, and I use this as a spiritual term, it's a cross-cutting word because it is a term the Buddhists used. It's a term that Christians understand. But the kind of detachment often was very materialistic, which is another form of materialism. If we are going to be so detached from any thing that feels good, like a musical instrument, and we think we shouldn't have or couldn't have a better one, that's a materialistic form of detachment. That is not what Adler meant by detachment. He meant detachment from our own limited understanding. And that's a much harder quality to achieve, to be able to set oneself aside and to listen. I remember some years ago there were a group of people at the UN who were bringing ambassadors in to speak about their cultures. And once we had the Chinese ambassador come, and he started with the size of his country. And he said, you know, when you have a country the size of ours, the first thing you really need is order. And he said, you may not agree with how we keep order, but we would just ask you to understand that when you're dealing with any one culture, you do have to see the urgency of its core concern. Which was, I thought, is a wonderful diplomatic way to at least allow us to engage in a quality kind of discussion that we could learn more, walk away with more, knowing that we hadn't changed each other's minds in terms of how we suggest procedure and that kind of thing. What I took away from that was, well, what was the United States' core need? And I would say it was liberty. that if people say to me, well, explain your country, it's such a mess, and I'd say, it really is in a way, because we're still in the discourse of what we think of as liberty. So I start with having people look at the Statue of Liberty and say, for example, that statue was given to us by another country. And it was given to us by a country that was struggling with the same issue. So it doesn't. So the Lady of Liberty doesn't represent a great accomplishment. It represents the deliberate intention to build it and to create it. And that it's important, and I think Bono and Luke know, that it's not that we've gotten far enough along, but as we get farther along and as we demand and continue to demand inclusiveness, we recognize that a country that gets formed on something and adheres to its focus learns to do it better as it goes along, if we understand what it was designed for. And that we then recognize when we are more detached, there is a paradox that we know better whom to belong with. And we know that, for example, we're here and we're not necessarily in agreement with each other for each other's points, nor would we necessarily want to live each other's lives or to have each other's heartaches or losses. But somehow we've distilled our own individual process and we recognize the importance of belonging to that group that lifts us up and expands us. That's what my point was this morning, Bono and Luke, that I wanted to just get you engaged in something that you could know. Organizational development that is open to the future is built on a vision, and you have to know the vision that you belong in order to shape the creativity and the creative expression. But we then recognize, okay, if we're microbes of a living universe that's all made up of the same stuff and that's all controlled by energy and force, and that we humans have somehow been gifted with a special capacity to grasp the significance of that, we then recognize, well, the organic joining of groupings is that where we have the most shared identity from the place of our vision, out of which flows then our practice. So Adler's notion about detachment was particular to humanity. And it wasn't about the kind of detachment that animals have or detachment of some of the specific practices in the church or the notion of sacrifice. For him was what the Latin word actually meant, which is to make holy. Sacrum anficio, to make holy, is the point of sacrifice. And Adler understood language. He spoke 9 languages. So, you know, certainly the origin of certain terms. He called our religion a religion of duty, but he didn't mean of drudgery. He never meant that. He meant the religion of a courage that out of one's own love for oneself, you could actually set the limited notion of it aside in order to devote oneself to a greater purpose. I don't know why, but the direction and the thrust of my life took me from a small town on the edge of Appalachia to the United Nations, where, ironically, that is where I feel most at home. And I feel most at home there because of the diversity that is in classes, because I never know who is going to come and teach me something. And it is so often a person who's in a wheelchair, or a person who is willing to translate their Russian into English so that I can understand their wisdom. And more than that, I would say, and this is the last point that I want to make, Adler's third point about spiritual practice, he called identification. And I love that word, because while it is rooted in compassion, and it does speak to empathy, identification is that ability to really walk in the other's shoes. And it put me in touch with my father, who was alcoholic and was raised to believe that despite his disease, he should control the purse. And it was very interesting to watch the struggles that the two of them had. And I felt guilty all the time because as a child, even though I didn't agree with him, I did identify with him. I could see what it was like to be a white man who was wanting to be ambitious, who was an only child, who was a child who was an only child because his older sister had died from scarlet fever and his mother never recovered from the loss of that child. So identification is not feeling sorry for, and nor is it about leaving home, if one needs to leave home, which I did at 18. It is about recognizing we don't have to carry any of that when we identify. And we don't have to stop being U.S. citizens when the wrong person gets elected. And we don't have to become counter-aggressors of those who are fundamentally struggling with the economic problem of disparity that exists in this country. And so we have gotten the chance to observe a peculiar coalition between those who have a high degree of autonomy and believed that they might vote for an alternative to a system that was going down a certain road and would have continued to go down a certain road if the other person were elected. So we don't make things necessarily good or bad. We simply know that the country reached a nexus point of crisis and that it's clear that the crisis is there by reason of the way the election played out. And in knowing those facts, which I know you all know much too well, I just bring them up to say, to illustrate what identification looks like. It makes some of us more sensitive to liberty, more sensitive to the fact that the more people we bring to the table, LGBTQI, Asian, African, those who've known slavery, those of people of color who've not known slavery, if we bring them together somehow and we keep doing our thing, somehow we will get closer to where we need to be. And that we won't forget 300 years is not, 350 years is not a very long time to have a national identity. So our national identity is really not forged. And it brings to mind, well, what do we identify with? How strongly do we identify with liberty, and how will that work in social reconstruction, which is one of Adler's book, The Social Reconstruction of the Ideal. And that the language that he uses is pretty archaic, and it reminds me of trying to learn Latin. which, by the way, I taught only because they needed teachers, so they made me take a minor. So I learned the value of somehow trying to learn things you weren't terribly good at, and that you can teach people who are better than you are if you just tell them what you know and honestly admit what you don't know. They'll figure it out. So with identification, it's a highly sophisticated concept. And it's that quality that makes one and brings one into such a large arena as, say, the United Nations. I'd like to stop there, if that's okay, because I want you to ask me questions. I wanted to ask if you might want to bring up other challenges. I did want to leave you with just a closing appreciation. And did I talk too long? Okay. The questions that I ask myself a lot is, do I live in scarcity or do I live in sufficiency? I had a conversation with some friends who were planning a program, and she was talking about moving to a bigger house in California, and I said, actually, I'm contemplating living in my office in Manhattan, which is 360 square feet. But what we were doing was not illustrating difference as much as we were identifying with how each other saw the future, one who lives in great density or one who lives in more spaciousness. And what I was communicating was, for me, to achieve 360 square feet would be sufficiency. It wouldn't be scarcity. And it didn't mean that the way she was thinking about sufficiency in a big house with land was in any way opposing my notion of scarcity, that we're just trending toward alternatives and differences. And there is no one way to live. If I've learned anything in being in more than one culture, I have learned there is more than one way to live and to live well. But it has somehow to do with this notion of scarcity. And I will say, and this is Martha speaking, it's my opinion, that we are being fed scarcity by the economic system in which we live. So when I go to the United Nations and focus on the Sustainable Development Goals, it's kind of the bottom line point for me is, don't talk about prosperity or economy until the people and the planet are at the table. Then talk to me about the economy, because we have to get to an economy of life, not an economy that's built upon capital. Capital's an abstraction. It doesn't exist. It's paper. People and the earth are the same thing, and more people around the world know that. If you forgot about the country's boundaries and you talk to people, everyone knows that in their bones. It's the simplest concept in the world. But I ask myself, because I am a U.S. citizen, when do I feel scarcity? The other question I ask myself a lot is, when do I feel neediness over gratitude? I personally feel neediness a lot of times when I feel I'm not really good at things. I really don't think of myself as the greatest speaker in the world. I will do it because maybe I have something to say or because I put myself in the position. But I'm always thinking, oh, you know, what a mess. And the other thing is, when am I living courageously? Because I know my fear. There have been times in my life where my life was threatened, or my reputation, or my capacity to earn money was threatened. And I know what it is to be really, really scared. And I know what it feels like to think, I don't know how to live in New York City. I thought, whatever did you, you know, I was responsible because I married a person who couldn't live outside New York City. So I was responsible, but I thought, what did I do? And what am I going to do with this? And how am I going to manage this? But you know what I learned was that if I stopped thinking about it from the way I was thinking about it and just did it, what I would find was that now I have three children who have children, all who speak two languages. Two of them speak Japanese-American, and one of them speaks Spanish-American, and he's in a Chinese preschool and thinks he can speak Chinese. What a great mindset for a four-year-old. So that wouldn't have happened to me, and that's what I feel comfortable with. I feel comfortable at my family gatherings where people get on for a certain while speaking English, and then over time they break into three different languages, and I can sit and feel comfortable. I may not understand every word, but I know I'm welcome, and I know that if I need a translation, somebody will give it to me. And that's my family. That's my intimate family. So this is what I would just say to you, that I think this is the world that's trending, and I think it's everywhere. I think everywhere we have refugees, and we have immigrants, and we have all kinds of different nationalities, and it will be different for different places. So I want to thank you for being so affirming, so kind, so growing, so good for these amazing children. We even brought up how foster care is a way toward the future. It's a trending toward large family. I couldn't say that if it weren't there at the table. And I compliment you for bringing together a diverse intergenerational society that welcomes its young and honors people like me. So thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.